What happens in our youth ripples through our entire lives. Early encounters and losses have the potency to continue reshaping us as we move through life. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea. Author Mary Lee McDonald gave up for adoption her firstborn child. She was a teenager, but went on to marry the child's father and have four more children with him. However, that early loss left a traumatic scar, right alongside her initial trauma, as she too had been adopted as an infant. She tells her story in Surrender, a memoir of nature, nurture, and love. And we'll talk with her in just a minute. The firestorms that destroyed homes and lives and whipped through Sonoma Mountain in 2017 drove artist Elisa Stancil Levine from her home. She ultimately did not lose her home, but the episode threw her into a reflection of her own life that she represents in This or Something Better, a memoir of resilience. Mary Lee McDonald is the author of several works of fiction, including the novel Montpelier Tomorrow and Body Language, a collection of short stories. But it is her own life and the desire to share her story with the son she gave up as an infant that she mines in Surrender, a memoir of nature, nurture, and love. Mary Lee herself was adopted as an infant and didn't find her birth mother until Mary Lee was well into her 30s. When she became pregnant as a teenager and was forced to give up her son, like the mother who gave her up, the primal wounds she experienced from both of these events became real and searing in her life. She needed to find her own mother, and she needed to find her firstborn son. This is her story. You were adopted as an infant, your birth mother was a teenager, and you yourself relinquished or surrendered a child when you gave birth as a teenager. These are two defining episodes. So tell us about you being an adopted child and you giving up a child and kind of how that shaped your life.
I think every life maybe has a theme, and adoption certainly is a big theme in my life. The effects of having been adopted for me were that I grew up not imagining that I had parents out there somewhere who might be alive, because like most adopted kids my age, I was told that my parents were killed in a car accident. So that foreclosed the possibility of, you know, having imaginary parents. But I did feel very, very different just as a person from the people who were raising me. And in fact, when I read the biography of Steve Jobs, Walter Jacobson's wonderful biography of him, the first chapter is about Steve Jobs being adopted and having parents who were quite different, more intellectual. They were graduate students versus the parents who raised him. And so I was placed in a family that had parents who were personality-wise and just in terms of the family dynamic, I felt really that I had been placed on Mars and was being raised by aliens. But that was my reality. And that was what I, you know, I coped with and knew. And it was just ironic that when I was 15 and a half and met the man who would later become my husband, that I repeated the behavior that had led to my own adoption. And I found myself pregnant. I was Catholic. Of course, that has a big impact. And it was in the days before birth control. Guys couldn't buy condoms if they were underage. Under 18, they couldn't buy them at the pharmacy. And so it was just a whole other era. And I found out that my birth mother was in fact possibly alive on the day that my mother asked me directly, is it possible you could be pregnant? And that's when she told me, yeah, oh, well, you're just like your mother. That was how I found out that there were these two strands in my life and that they collided, they intersected very dramatically in that moment when my mother revealed the secret of me, the secret of my birth. So yeah, that's what the story is about. It's about the theme of those two adoptions layering on top of one another.
I was very interested in some notions you brought up in the book about adopted children. And you talk about a concept called developmental PTSD. And as I understand it, that an infant, after it is born and separated from its birth mother, birth family, there are some who think it develops a form of PTSD from that initial life trauma of being separated at birth. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. And what do you believe about that notion of developmental PTSD?
Well, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a writer, but I have lived this. And so I first came across this notion of developmental PTSD in a really important book called Primal Wound by Nancy Verrier. And she is an adoptive mother who wondered and tried to get at the root causes of her adopted daughter's intense anger when she was a teen. It was in contrast to the daughter that she had had biologically. And so she began delving into this, and she was the first to really write about this. Since then, there's been a lot of other work, many other psychologists dealing with this. And why is it PTSD? Well, it's PTSD because the infant comes out expecting to hear a certain heartbeat. Well, they've been inside the womb and they've acclimated to the mother's womb for 9 months. And they come out and they don't have a familiar smell. They don't have a familiar heartbeat. You think about how in a normal birth, an infant is now laid on top of the mother immediately. In the case of an adopted child, in the case of me, in that era, the baby was whisked away and the mother was not even allowed to see the baby. And so there was no contact. I actually was placed in the foster home for 3 weeks. And then I was finally placed in the home with the parents who raised me. But that is a kind of pre-verbal trauma. It's a separation and it leaves a very deep wound in terms of abandonment. I experience abandonment. I was yanked away from my mother and placed in another environment and never saw her, never saw anybody that looked like me until I was 35 years old and tracked her down.
When you did that, you don't talk a lot about your birth mother in the book. And I'm wondering what that experience was like for you and for her. And because you don't talk a lot about her in the book, I'm wondering if it was somehow disappointing or...
Oh, no, not disappointing at all. No, gosh, it was wonderful. The reason I didn't talk about it is because it's a different storyline. I guess I have some thought that I might write a book about that reunion. But my mother, I have relationships with my siblings. So that becomes more complicated because all those people would have to, you know, buy in. But no, it was wonderful. I met somebody for the first time who was like me, who looked like me, who was really smart. We had so many things in common. But she had been traumatized by having been shamed. This was in 1945, having been shamed and sent away to have me in a home that was very much like the Magdalen homes in Ireland, which are notorious, run by nuns. So if you were pregnant, it would be a very weird experience to be going and living among nuns, you know, for the duration of your pregnancy, and to be told that you're not going to college. You're going to get a job as a secretary, and because you'll probably just get married. You know, we're not going to waste anything more on you because you've disappointed us. My mother was shamed and really bore the scars of that shame. I had a wonderful reunion with her, and I'm very lucky to have four siblings with whom I now have a lot of shared experience. The first time in my life I saw anybody who looked like me, who was like me, who had my sense of humor. My siblings have all done well academically. We just share a lot of common characteristics.
And you also, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but you do have a reunion and an ongoing relationship with your son, who you ended up giving up for adoption also. And kind of similar circumstances that you weren't sent to a convent, but you were in the later stages of your pregnancy, your mother, your adoptive mother, and you went to Phoenix, where you eventually gave birth, and you were with other girls, women who were also waiting to give birth and resume their lives. And you were in love with the father, and being an adopted child yourself, it just must have been very confusing. And in some ways, you come across as being kind of naive at that period of your life. So talk about the decision not to keep that child.
Oh, it was not a decision. It was a foregone conclusion that I was not going to keep that child. First of all, I was underage, so legally, I had no say in the matter. My husband's father was just determined. My future husband's father was just determined that his son was not going to be roped into getting married at 16, at 17. He was 17, I was 16. And so, you know, the adults just basically took charge. And it wasn't like it is now, where you could say, oh, yes, if you're pregnant, you would make a plan, you would find a home, you would screen parents and decide who the parents were that were going to raise your child. No, I mean, it was a foregone conclusion that we would give up our babies. And I had never even seen a woman who was pregnant. Maybe in the grocery store or something. So I didn't know anything about birth. I barely knew. I mean, I knew the rudiments of how people got pregnant. I knew, you know, I'd had the class in sixth grade that everybody else had, but that was all I knew. So when it came to thinking about my own adoption, you know, it seemed like the most natural thing. Well, okay, a lot of kids are adopted. I was adopted and it worked out okay for me. So I just kind of went along with the program. Not that I had any choice in the matter. I had no economic power. I think that was a key thing. I had no economic power and I had no parental support for even considering keeping my child. The only way I could have done that is if my husband would have married me.
And you were open to that.
Oh my God, I definitely wanted to, yeah, I wanted to get married.
And you eventually do marry him. But if I'm reading everything correctly, you married him and you were pregnant when you married him.
Yep.
And you went on to have four children with him, though he died young and your last child was born after his death. It sounds like your husband never really, though you had this son together that was given away, that was not something he wanted to ever revisit, even when you had, or maybe especially because you had these other children. So But you as a mother, that yearning never went away. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that decision that your husband really, as you represented it in the book, it seemed like, no, he didn't want to ever talk about it.
Oh, he forbid me from talking about it. I tried to talk to him. I wanted to find out if our son was alive, if he had been adopted, if he was okay. I mean, of course, I was yearning for this baby, like any mother. I mean, it's like Moses being pushed out into the river. You know, I was standing in the reeds and I had pushed my little baby out into the river and I didn't know if he'd gone over the falls or if somebody had found him. And so I was in Germany. My husband had a PhD, got a PhD from Stanford. And we were living in Germany and I was watching my younger boys grow up and just thinking, oh my God, this is killing me. I mean, there was not a day that went by that I did not think about this child that I had surrendered. So I told John, I said, I really want to find out what's going on. And I wrote to the agency and they gave me some non-identifying information. So I knew he had been adopted from what they told me, very, very sketchy information. It sounded like he was just like my other kids, you know, engaged in Cub Scouts, physically healthy, doing very well in school. But my husband didn't want to hear it. And I think it was just too painful for him. He had always imagined having a son. He was the oldest boy in his family, so he knew what that meant to be the oldest boy. I think it was just too painful. He thought that it was possible to forget that our child existed. And you know, I, of course, lived with that child inside my body for nine months, and I found it was not possible to forget. So ultimately, when he was 21, I did have to go and do a search and find him. And by that time, his father had been killed in a car accident. So he never got to meet his father, but he did get to meet his flesh and blood full siblings. And I think that's been a real joy for all of us.
So you have two children, your youngest who never met his dad and your oldest.
Correct.
Who also never met his dad. And he wanted to find you too, correct? That your son was open to meeting with you and getting to know his other siblings.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He was really excited. You know, when I called him and, you know, introduced myself, he got really excited and started jumping up and down on the couch. It's my mom. It's my mom. And then he came out for Christmas and had the experience of being in a freezing Illinois winter Christmas with snow all around and having to take a sled to the grocery store because the snow was so bad. But anyway, we just all holed up in the house together and got to know one another. We played endless games, board games, and talked and cooked and ate and chopped wood. And so, yeah, life resumed at that point. But the thing about, you could say that's a wonderful thing, you know, that we finally met each other. But the thing I've found is that it really takes some time to create a common history. Our own history, our own family culture, and try to weave all of this back together again.
Yes, you don't have that shared history. But there's something very primal between you and your son, getting back to that kind of original trauma. There's something you shared, he shared with you in utero. And I imagine that it's a challenging and it's sometimes a confusing situation with having this innate feeling for one another, but not a shared experience, that maybe you're always tentative or questioning your bonds or having to maybe reflect on who you are today. So I can imagine that it's challenging and gratifying to work through the separation to find a sense of union with your child.
Yeah, it's challenging and it's healing. I mean, even if things are not always perfect, in the beginning of the book, he comes to visit me in Phoenix. And actually, this was the impetus for me writing this book in the first place. I'm really more of a fiction writer, and writing a memoir was kind of the furthest thing from my mind. But John came to visit me in Phoenix, which is where I surrendered him. And we were sitting in a Starbucks, and he said, you know, well, how did it happen? We're in Phoenix now for the first time since you gave birth, and tell me the story of my birth. So I thought, well, gosh, you know, I've told him the story of his birth verbally over and over. I mean, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions, but what he was asking me, I thought, was to go into detail about the, you know, the qualitative experience of being a teenager and an unwed mother, and, you know, that life-altering experience. What was it like to be with my husband, his father?
And you just mentioned that you mainly have been a fiction writer, and you do have a couple of big books of short stories. And I'm wondering what was the difference in your process?
The difference in my process was having to confront the pain of that experience. In my short stories, there's always an element of Mary Lee in the short stories. You know, maybe it's someplace I've traveled, maybe it's somebody I've met. There's an element of my real life experience, or at least my real life viewpoint about the experience I'm writing about. I write literary fiction in general, but in this case, I had to take the two most painful experiences of my life and try to figure out how to structure them so that they would make sense to somebody who didn't want to get bogged down in the minutia. In other words, I wanted to structure this book so that it would be as readable as a novel and would have a focus just on the experience of my adoption, my son's adoption, and the tremendous abandonment feelings that, you know, lie at the heart of that experience for me. It was a bit of a discovery process for me to figure out, what is the story here? You know, I had this experience, but really, what is the story? Because all sorts of other things happened in my life. I got remarried. I had other children. I had jobs. All of that has to be pushed aside, ultimately, in order to get to the core story, which had to do with surrendering a baby or relinquishing a baby. In order to write that, I had to immerse myself in those feelings. And it was incredibly hard to do. I worked with an editor, great editor. I don't normally work with an editor because I'm an editor myself. Honestly, I don't think I could have finished the book if she hadn't sort of been there cheering me on, saying, come on, Mary Lee, this is a story that needs to be told. Get through this chapter, then get through the next chapter. And this was after I had a rough draft. This book's probably gone through like 30 drafts to get to the point that it is.
The book is Surrender, a memoir of nature, nurture, and love. And I'm talking with Mary Lee McDonald, its author. And before we say goodbye, I guess I'm wondering, things have changed quite a bit in the world of adoption. On one level, you know, I think at the heart of it, the same situations are often at play. But I wonder what your message is for those who have either been adopted or who have surrendered their own child.
And I guess I would say that from my lived experience, that it is extremely hard to form a sense of identity during the teenage years and the young adult years if you are adopted, because you do not have the mirrors that people who are not adopted have all around them. You know, the family members, you look like Aunt so-and-so. Oh, you have that talent from your artistic talent from so-and-so. I didn't discover that until I was 35. And at that point, the pieces of who I was fell into place. And I felt for the first time in my life, this is who I am. This is what I am supposed to be doing. But most of all, just that core sense of this is who I am. I was no longer casting about for a sense of self. If I had to say one thing, it's that forming a sense of identity is extremely hard without the mirror of family. And that is what makes adoption problematic.
Mary Lee, thank you so much for bringing me your book and for talking with me about it.
Well, thanks a lot, and really enjoyed the conversation.
Mary Lee McDonald and her book is Surrender, a Memoir of Nature, Nurture, and Love. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.
How does a sparrow know more than I when the mother is gone and learns how to fly?
Nature has always been the guide for Elisa Stancil Levine. It speaks to her. She is a successful artist, entrepreneur, and is the founder of Stancil Studios, a decorative painting and design firm that has created projects all over the world. Elisa grew up in California's gold country along the American River. She left school at 16 and became a single mother, only after losing her first child while still a teenager. During the firestorms of 2017, Elisa fled her threatened home with the thought that with patience and resilience, she would get through. It also drew her into a deep reflection on her early childhood experiences and traumas and the good fortune in her life. The 2017 fires closed in on Sonoma Mountain, where you live near Glen Ellen, and you fled. You did not ultimately lose your home, but it seems to be an event that galvanized your reflections on your life, and that's what you share in the book. So talk a little bit about how what you experienced in the wake of those fires stimulated your thinking on your own life and why you used it as the galvanizing architecture in the memoir.
Yes. So what I think is really interesting about crises is it's a paleontology, really, of your other characteristics. Suddenly, you know, you are confronted with tendencies that you might not have realized that you had. They may be good, or they may be, you know, surprising and not so advantageous. And in the case of the fire, my expectation was that I would be this ultimately survivor, you know, and fantastic at all the things that I needed to do. And in fact, I found that I had no regard for the other humans on our road, never thought of them as I left in the middle of the night with my husband and had to leave behind our horses. You know, I was very upset about the horses. And then just making my own list of how to go about the future, you know, very organized and thinking that I was, you know, insulated somehow. And in fact, after the fire the whole firestorm was over, I came to grapple with the fact that I was armored, not insulated, armored from an unintended consequence of denying my relationship pretty much with humans. I was very, very attached and affiliated with anything natural. But the idea of humans was not necessarily comfortable or safe. And this memoir and the structure, and really it's almost like, let's just say it's a device using the fire as a way to organize the recollections of my life and how I could have come to this moment, right, at 69 or whatever I was, 68 years old, and suddenly realizing that, you know, my nature girl story was getting got a hole burned into it from the fire. And I couldn't just go around saying, oh, look at me, I'm a nature girl. Therefore, I'm done. No, I'm not done. And if I have 20 more years, one hopes, to persist on the planet, I should open my door of wonder to the human nature, not just nature, the natural world. So that's the impetus behind the book and using the fire.
Yes, yes. So you have had some tragic and disturbing episodes in your life, and you start telling us about them pretty quickly in the book. But you also have had some incredibly good fortune as well.
Yes.
And as you just said, you described yourself as a nature girl, and nature has always been an important teacher for you. So I wonder if you could talk about what you've learned through that ever-changing balance of good fortune and tragedy and loss.
I really think that the earliest memory and the blessing that I got from feeling connected on the planet and welcomed here by nature, you know, when I was maybe a year and a half old, that gave me this footing that I just can't imagine what I would have done without. And the idea that there's good and bad was quite clear to me as a very tiny child because of the relationships that I had in my family of origin, both my parents and my father's mother and her husband, who was my step-grandfather. So this early having to come to terms with the fact that things are not always the way that you want them to be, and that if you want to make them different, I mean, it seemed to me it would be up to me. And so this early, you know, sort of industrious effort to make my world as best I could did also kind of cause me to just be really self-reliant. And in the self-reliance, and then I would, you know, ask for help. I would ask for signs in nature when I needed help. And I would get these great signs. I mean, it was totally, totally a blessing. And I think it's because I'm looking, and because maybe of my creative tendency and my strong visual memory, you know, I would just return immediately to these kind of tools that worked. So that was one of the things that made it possible. And of course, the things that happened to me happen to some degree to everyone, maybe one or two or three or four or five, but this seems like an awful lot that happened to me. And when writing about it, I felt kind of bad that the reader would have to be wading through all these things, you know, and I have to say, I took some things out so that it wouldn't be so daunting. But yet, when I go to a book club or something that people are talking to me as an author, they'll just say, you know, like, how did you do it? And I just keep thinking, wow, they're worried for me. I mean, I was always sort of, except for that period of 4 years where I was really completely lost after the death of my fiance and business loss, I was like always sort of looking on the bright side, I must say. That's sort of a tendency. And that's just, you know, I'm just going forward, moving on, you know, something better. That's where I'm going.
And it seems like from a relatively young age that you laid yourself open and talked to God as you knew God whenever you felt confused or vulnerable, or you just wanted some direction. And it seems like, as you just said, you opened yourself up. You paid attention to the world around you, and that is where you got a lot of cues or direction. And later in life, you converted to Judaism. And I wonder if you can just kind of globally talk about or describe your spirituality, its evolution, and its continued importance in your life.
Well, yeah, I think that as you recognized in reading the early chapters, I mean, there was a lot of pressure on the fact that my mother was Catholic. So she was the only Catholic person that I knew, but she was, you know, definitely taking us to church. And this Catholic idea, even leaving aside the fact that it totally inflamed my grandmother into a strange behavior, if you just look at the Catholic reality, for me, it was just made no sense. It was so sad. And I also would just sit and look at Jesus on the cross at my particular church. And there he is. Okay, I find out later it's 32 hours or something that they say that he was on the cross. I mean, my whole life can't be about the fact of 32 hours of this man. That is not okay with me. And so I just thought there was something very awry about the whole Catholic theme. Every time they came up with something that needed to be done, Stations of the Cross or whatever else, it was something that was made up by a person and didn't have anything to do with God. Okay, that's it. No. So I was on the lookout for something else. And I had also learned that I still did really believe in a force beyond myself, and that I also learned how to edit. So I could see whatever I could find that was good. I liked the incense. I liked this and that. And so as time went on, I went through a lot of different choices of religion, you know, Buddhism, Taoism, all kinds of other theories, Sufism, you know, something far afield seemed to be a good idea. And yet, I don't know if you remember in the book where after losing my first baby, I had these dreams. I would be falling asleep and I would just sink down into sleep and I'd see this ancient writing. And I was reading this ancient writing and turning the book from left to right, the page, and reading this ancient, and everything about it was absolutely true. And I loved it. And then I would try to wake myself up from the dream and come up with the information so I could see what it was in, you know, today's world. But there was nothing. It would just evaporate. And so this went on for, I mean, I think about 3 weeks, almost every night. I mean, just loved that I got this, you know, the truth of life, right? And then I forgot all about it. And when I met my husband, when we were first dating, he had said, you know, I think you might be Jewish and not know it. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, because you seem to have a prayer for everything. And, you know, you're sort of always keeping kosher with the way that you have these food allergies. I'm like, okay. But what really turned me toward Judaism was how I saw the children being treated in his family, and where you could have a big, huge table of family all talking happily. And a six-year-old might start to say something and the whole table silences. And they're like, what is she or he saying? You know, they're listening. Okay. This is new. I like this. This is good. So a child's being treated as a whole being. Thank you. And then, I don't know, 8 years later, we're still dating. Okay. And I asked him to write my name in Hebrew. And he wrote it in cursive first, and it didn't really mean anything to me. And then he started writing it in the calligraphic style. And all of a sudden, the first letter of my last name, Stanzel, is the shin, which is the shin. The shin is actually this mark I made for myself maybe 15 years prior to that, that is my logo. And I'm like, well, that's my logo. That is and this is the ancient writing. This is the ancient writing. And so I started to cry, of course, because it was so profound for that moment. And then he said that is a yod. It's a symbol of the ancient rabbis, a symbol that they would use also with their fingers as a blessing. So I was really moved because I thought of it always as the three finger that you're touching. My symbol meant you're touching the heart of another. My three fingers would touch the center of their chest, right? That was just profound. Then yet I didn't convert right away. And again, I must confess happily that I used editing techniques to make the best parts of the religion my own for me.
You grew up in Placerville. Your grandmother that you just referred to lived in Camino.
Yes.
And you were surrounded by nature, but you also found these places kind of provincial. And at one point you decide that you want to go away to school and your parents reluctantly agree. And I wonder if you could talk about that experience, what you had hoped for and the reality of it, because I think the reality of it was a little bit different. And you were, in fact, asked to leave that school. And I wonder if that was a humiliation that stayed with you or a failure. Just talk a little bit about your desire and the reality of it.
Well, I think, again, a very good example of unintended consequences. I was already set up to skip a couple of big classes as a freshman in high school in my town based on testing. So and I was in the gifted program and all that. And yet there wasn't really much of an expectation of a woman, girl in the gifted program in 1963, 64 in that town. You know, just didn't seem to have any bearing on what I wanted to do, which was write and do art. And so I was inspired to go to this school. It happened to be a Catholic boarding school. I just, sort of overlooked that, decided to go down and see what it was like because Sister Mary Carita was this famous, at the moment, nun who was doing this incredible collage art against the war in Vietnam. Okay, so she's alive and awake, and her, meaningful poster she had put out was, "I greet the light within you." And I'm just like, oh, thank you. This is the person. These are my people. So I went and toured the school. Everything was wonderful. I took all the testing. I was accepted. Everything was good. The mother superior came out from behind her desk and hugged me, which I thought was so wonderful, right? Because women in power made me anxious due to my grandmother's problems. So I felt comfortable. And everything is good. I was a little bit, concerned what will be happening and what will people in my town think now that I've decided they were subpar. And, but I would go off and seek my fortune, right? So when I got there, though, almost immediately I realized something was very different. And the art studio was completely locked up. So what could this be? I mean, here I am my first day and the things that I had come here for are not there, right? And then I realized that they've had a complete regime change and I could not cope with the white gloves and silent retreat and the focus on Catholic liturgy, right? That was just not something for me. And then girls were stealing things from me in the dorm, my shoes, okay? That is just weird. So I just found that, I've spent most of my time at the nurse's office eating cookies and warm milk, which was nice. And I gained like 20 pounds probably. And when I got home, after they told me that I had to leave because I didn't belong there. I definitely did not belong there. They said I was pseudo sophisticated, which to me was like beyond the slap in the face. Okay. So, I mean, first of all, how would they know, A? And B, what do they mean? So, I had to discount that. So you'll see in the book that when things come up that are really, really, really offensive to me, I just do all I can to discount them. They can't be right. Now, that doesn't mean I hadn't been pretentious and might not still be pretentious in some ways sometimes, which I guess some people will be. It isn't an intention, but it is a defense usually, I think. And so it was hard. And coming home to, having failed at my effort, the gossip in our little town with small minds was that I had gone away and got pregnant, and that's why I had gained weight. So that was a deeper hole that I had gotten dug into. Another huge, much, much more certainly unforeseen consequence of just going away. And then my response to that was, okay, the only thing I can do to lose weight is run. I used to be a cross-country runner in grade school, so I do great. And we had five women, girls in my high school that had super great scores. And there was a new thing where there were some women track teams, not at my school yet, but there were some even before Title IX. So I went to the principal and asked to get the chance to start the track team and explain to him who I had collected and who we could compete against. And he said, well, give me a week. I need to talk about it and we'll come back. So I came back in a week fully expecting that it would be good. And I just tell this now because I think it will be kind of telling to the listeners that you know, the meeting was started with him saying, I think you're going to like what we've come up with for you and the girls. I said, great. What is it? Well, we're going to give you your own little clipboards and your own little stopwatches, and you're going to have your own uniforms. We even thought of a name for you. You're going to be the Trackettes, and you're going to keep the boys' times. And I mean, I just, my face fell. I turned to Ash, and I'm sure I just felt like throwing up on the guy.
Right.
And he said, you know, we know you just want to be out there to spend time with the boys.
So it seems like just in what you're talking about right now in these two examples of, you know, people who thought you had gone off and had a baby and then kind of being thwarted and pushed into more of a stereotypical role at that point, your reaction, or I believe you even called it a plan, you did get pregnant.
Well, yeah, my first reaction was that there's nothing here for me and I shouldn't even be in this school. I made it through that year and halfway into the sophomore year and I decided, you know, I'm lonely and it's weird. I don't know what to do. I think I will get a boyfriend. Why wouldn't I? You know, I don't know anything about that, but I'll have a boyfriend. And the boyfriend that I had had, which is in the book, was an incredibly wonderful young man. And I thought he was fantastic, but my mother decided to leave my father and marry my boyfriend's father. And that was going to make my boyfriend my stepbrother. And then my father managed to thwart that. And my boyfriend and the man who was his father left town. The man was my father's accountant and CPA. And so it was just horrifying. And they disappeared with no one knew where they went. Actually, they went to Ireland, and that's why I never found him until many years later when he found me. So he was gone. My future, a stellar future was gone, you know, and I'm just floundering around there in Placerville, you know, under the effigy of the hanged man near the hangman's bar. I mean, it's just it's not a good, happy town. Sorry, just not. So I thought, well, a boyfriend, you know, and that was the plan. The plan would be I find someone strong because I'm strong. I'm durable. I need somebody strong and durable. So I saw this boy taking a girl out over his head at a dance. And I thought, oh, look how strong he is. And everybody was laughing and happy. And I thought, well, then that could be my boyfriend. So that was my boyfriend. As time passed and I had many other love affairs, shall we say, or attempted love affairs with men and husbands, my list increased. Okay, so from strong, okay, that's good. Then the next one was strong and smart, and then the next and creative, and then the next one was strong, smart, creative, and likes to work. Okay, and then the next one was a really long list, and it didn't even happen until 15 years later, and that's when I met my fourth husband. Now, I left the whole husband out of the book because, I mean, poor readers. I mean, it's only so much you can take. But my mother used to always say, can't we just leave this one off? You know, and so I thought I took her advice. This out of the frying pan into the fire is not the first and only time that happened to me with my own clever machinations. I guess that's part of what happens when you leave it all up to yourself and think that you can't trust other humans. You're not going to ask for advice, right?
Things worked out for you even when they didn't work out. That's how I perceived it in the book. While you were a young woman and had this baby, which was born, it was stillborn.
Yeah.
It seems like then you're all the more determined to have another one. And you do have a son, but it was something that it seemed like during the course of your life, when you wanted something, you would get it and it would not always be perfect, but you rolled with it. And I think of the many times you and your son were looking for housing and you found something and it turned into something else that eventually blossomed into, you know, a career. And so it seems like that is even part of the lesson you might, if you're, I don't know that you're trying to impart a lesson, but it's the lesson of your life, at least.
Yeah, it was interesting with the writing, trying not to make it like shine a light on something I think somebody's supposed to get from the book. I don't like that when that happens to me when I'm reading a book. I just don't like it. So I wasn't trying to do that. I was just trying to show the pondering that happened and some of the quick action that happened and some of the, you know, detours that happened that came from being a courageous, creative, and curious child. And maybe the main lesson would be your children are very brilliant, okay? Trust them that they might know something you don't know, right? And, you know, go with them on their adventure. That's how I was with my son. I mean, you want to just, you know, celebrate that they're on the planet, right? And trust them with some self-knowledge, right? And learn from them. And it's just a wonderful way to go as a parent. Yes, there should be some structure. As my son has said, you know, I always knew I was loved. I always knew I was completely protected, but I could have used more structure. I said, oh, sorry.
There's a lot more here. And I wondered if you are one who keeps a diary and have you kept a diary through your entire life? Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned having a visual memory.
Visual memory, yes.
Because some of your passages are so descriptive. And so what is your writing process like?
Yes. Okay. Remember that from the time I was 8, really, I planned to write a book. So I was already collecting information and I already had, and it was pretty present in my brain at that time. I didn't write these things down. In fact, I have about 20 journals that I have about 5 pages written in them. And they all seem to be saying the same thing. So I don't really start a journal anymore. I don't care to do that. And this visual memory aspect has to do with, I'm a visual learner. I am completely not audio. And everything that I'm always studying color, contrast, proportion, presence, and absence. And that's why it's so easy for me to do these things in as a decorative artist. So I can just see when something is yearning to be a little bit closer or is too crowded, needs to have space in a pattern, for example, that kind of thing. And so everything is anthropomorphic. Every single thing I see is singing to me and to anybody else that can hear it, I'm sure, whatever it's saying about its essence. So when I go back in time to try to write about something, I can actually just re-enter that space and I'll write it and it might be overwritten or in some cases, sometimes underwritten, you know, and it needs to sit and like a steeping tea, right? And I might be all proud of it for a second. If I look back at it, even 2 days later, I'm like, oh, you know, not really. Okay. So it's kind of a harrowing write, rewrite, you know, like that.
I'm also wondering about you just a few minutes ago talked about children, the wisdom of children. And I'm wondering how becoming a grandmother changed you. You said something like it was like a tuning fork for your life.
That is the word. And I even use it sometimes with my other friends that are new grandparents. It was just, you know, I was anxious about the baby coming and wanting it to be healthy and okay, because having had very difficult traumas of pregnancy myself, but didn't want to bring that up because, you know, it's not common. So therefore, why alarm anybody? So there I'm just sort of standing by. And then the baby comes. And it was when I really had gone to visit their home after they'd gotten home from the hospital. And then I held her on my lap. And it was just, like I said, a tuning fork. And I think it, you know, reminded me of that whole thing from the Ben Gazzaret, or however it's pronounced, in Dune, where it was when I first learned that a baby girl is born with the eggs that will become her children. They're already there. And I just felt like this girl baby with me on the planet at the same time, just so grateful. And it just realigned everything around family for me, just like immediately, like a luminaria. It's just beautiful.
Elisa Stansel Levine, I appreciate your talking with me today. Is there anything you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I want to thank you for your wonderful reading of the book. I appreciate that so much. It's just really wonderful that you brought up these little bits and pieces that are you know, really kind of nuggets of everything that happened. And yes, I would like to leave your reader, your listeners, with this idea that you have a deep well of joy within you. And I'm so happy that you're listening today. Thank you.
My conversation with Elisa Stancil Levine on her book, This or Something Better, A Memoir of Resilience. Earlier, we heard from Mary Lee McDonald on her book, Surrender. I thank these two guests for their candor and our conversations together. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening. Music today was from Peter Jacobson and Ashley Monroe. We have production assistance from Will Penny and Mark Prell. You could subscribe to our podcast and listen to a whole bunch of past shows at krcb.org. Follow the radio program or podcast links. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. It's a novel idea.